Light on the Path by Mabel Collins. Comments, Part 1. Before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. It should be very clearly remembered by all readers of this volume that it is a book which may appear to have some little philosophy in it, but very little sense, to those who believe it to be written in ordinary English. To the many who read in this manner, it will be not caviar so much as olives strong of their salt. Be warned and read but little in this way. There is another way of reading, which is indeed the only one of any use with many authors. It is reading not between the lines but within the words. In fact, it is deciphering a profound cipher. All alchemical works are written in the cipher of which I speak. It has been used by the great philosophers and poets of all time. It is used systematically by the adepts in life and knowledge, who, seemingly giving out their deepest wisdom, hide in the very words which frame it its actual mystery. They cannot do more. There is a law of nature which insists that a man shall read these mysteries for himself. By no other method can he obtain them. A man who desires to live must eat his food himself. This is the simple law of nature, which applies also to the higher life. A man who would live and act in it cannot be fed like a babe with a spoon. He must eat for himself. I propose to put into new and sometimes plainer language parts of Light on the Path, but whether this effort of mine will really be any interpretation, I cannot say. To a deaf and dumb man, a truth is made no more intelligible if, in order to make it so, some misguided linguist translates the words in which it is couched into every living or dead language and shouts these different phrases in his ear. But for those who are not deaf and dumb, one language is generally easier than the rest. And it is to such as these I address myself. The very first aphorisms of Light on the Path, included under number 1, have, I know well, remained sealed as to their inner meaning to many who have otherwise followed the purpose of the book. There are 4 proven and certain truths with regard to the entrance to occultism. The gates of gold bar that threshold. Yet there are some who pass those gates and discover the sublime and illimitable beyond. In the far spaces of time, all will pass those gates. But I am one who wish that time, the great deluder, were not so overmasterful. To those who know and love him, I have no word to say. But to the others, and there are not so very few as some may fancy, to whom the passage of time is as the stroke of a sledgehammer, and the sense of space like the bars of an iron cage, I will translate and retranslate until they understand fully. The 4 truths written on the first page of Light on the Path referred to the trial initiation of the would-be occultist. Until he has passed it, he cannot even reach to the latch of the gate which admits to knowledge. Knowledge is man's greatest inheritance. Why then should he not attempt to reach it by every possible road? The laboratory is not the only ground for experiment. Science, we must remember, is derived from signs, present participle of sire, to know. Its origin is similar to that of the word discern, to ken. Science does not therefore deal only with matter, no, not even its subtlest and obscurest forms. Such an idea is born merely of the idle spirit of the age. Science is a word which covers all forms of knowledge. It is exceedingly interesting to hear what chemists discover and to see them finding their way through the densities of matter to its finer forms. But there are other kinds of knowledge than this, and it is not every one who restricts his, strictly scientific, desire for knowledge to experiments which are capable of being tested by the physical senses. Everyone who is not a dullard, or a man stupefied by some predominant vice, has guessed, or even perhaps discovered with some certainty, that there are subtle senses lying within the physical senses. There is nothing at all extraordinary in this. If we took the trouble to call nature into the witness box, we should find that everything which is perceptible to the ordinary sight has something even more important than itself hidden within it. The microscope has opened a world to us, but within those encasements which the microscope reveals lies a mystery which no machinery can probe. The whole world is animated and lit, down to its most material shapes, by a world within it. This inner world is called astral by some people, and it is as good a word as any other, though it merely means starry. But the stars, as Locke pointed out, are luminous bodies which give light of themselves. This quality is characteristic of the light which lies within matter. For those who see it need no lamp to see it by. The word star, moreover, is derived from the Anglo-Saxon stir on, to steer, to stir, to move, and undeniably it is the inner life which is the master of the outer, just as a man's brain guides the movements of his lips, so that although the astral is no very excellent word in itself, I am content to use it for my present purpose. The whole of Light on the Path is written in an astral cipher and can therefore only be deciphered by one who reads astrally. And its teaching is chiefly directed towards the cultivation and development of the astral life. Until the first step has been taken in this development, the swift knowledge, which is called intuition with certainty, is impossible to man. And this positive and certain intuition is the only form of knowledge which enables a man to work rapidly to reach his true and high estate within the limit of his conscious effort. To obtain knowledge by experiment is too tedious a method for those who aspire to accomplish real work. He who gets it by certain intuition lays hands on its various forms with supreme rapidity by fierce effort of will. As a determined workman grasps his tools, indifferent to their weight or any other difficulty which may stand in his way. He does not stay for each to be tested. He uses such as he sees are fittest. All the rules contained in Light on the Path are written for all disciples, but only for disciples, those who take knowledge. To none else but the student in this school are its laws of any use or interest. To all who are interested seriously in occultism, I say, first, take knowledge. To him who hath shall be given. It is useless to wait for it. The womb of time will close before you, and in later days you will remain unborn without power. I therefore say to those who have any hunger or thirst for knowledge, attend to these rules. They are none of my handicraft or invention. They are merely the phrasing of laws in supernature, the putting into words truths as absolute in their own sphere as those laws which govern the conduct of the earth and its atmosphere. The senses spoken of in these four statements are the astral or inner senses. No man desires to see that light which illumines the spaceless soul until pain and sorrow and despair have driven him away from life of ordinary humanity. First he wears out pleasure, then he wears out pain, till at last his eyes become incapable of tears. This is a truism, although I know perfectly well that it will meet with a vehement denial from many who are in sympathy with thoughts which spring from the inner life. To see with the astral sense of sight is a form of activity which it is difficult for us to understand immediately. The scientist knows very well that a miracle is achieved by each child that is born into the world, when it first conquers its eyesight and compels it to obey its brain. An equal miracle is performed with each sense certainly, but this ordering of sight is perhaps the most stupendous effort. Yet the child does it almost unconsciously, by force of the powerful heredity of habit. No one now is aware that he has ever done it at all, just as we cannot recollect the individual movements which enabled us to walk up a hill a year ago. This arises from the fact that we move and live and have our being in matter. Our knowledge of it has become intuitive. With our astral life, it is very much otherwise. For long ages past, man has paid very little attention to it, so little that he has practically lost the use of his senses. It is true that in every civilization the star arises, and man confesses, with more or less of folly and confusion, that he knows himself to be. But most often he denies it, and in being a materialist becomes that strange thing, a being which cannot see its own light, a thing of life which will not live, an astral animal which has eyes and ears and speech and power, yet will use none of these gifts. This is the case, and the habit of ignorance has become so confirmed that now none will see with the inner vision till agony has made the physical eyes not only unseeing but without tears, the moisture of life. To be incapable of tears is to have faced and conquered the simple human nature, and to have attained an equilibrium which cannot be shaken by personal emotions. It does not imply any hardness of heart or any indifference. It does not imply the exhaustion of sorrow when the suffering soul seems powerless to suffer acutely any longer. It does not mean the deadness of old age, when emotion is becoming dull because the strings which vibrate to it are wearing out. None of these conditions are fit for a disciple, and if any one of them exists in him, it must be overcome before the path can be entered upon. Hardness of heart belongs to the selfish man, the egotist, to whom the gate is forever closed. Indifference belongs to the fool and the false philosopher, those whose lukewarmness makes them mere puppets, not strong enough to face the realities of existence. When pain or sorrow has worn out the keenness of suffering, the result is a lethargy not unlike that which accompanies old age, as it is usually experienced by men and women. Such a condition makes the entrance to the path impossible, because the first step is one of difficulty and needs a strong man full of psychic and physical vigor to attempt it. It is a truth that, as Edgar Allan Poe said, the eyes are the window for the soul, the windows of that haunted palace in which it dwells. This is the very nearest interpretation into ordinary language of the meaning of the text. If grief, dismay, disappointment, or pleasure can shake the soul so that it loses its fixed hold on the calm spirit which inspires it, and the moisture of life breaks forth, drowning knowledge in sensation, then all is blurred, the windows are darkened, the light is useless. This is as literal a fact as that if a man at the edge of a precipice loses his nerve through some sudden emotion, he will certainly fall. The poise of the body, the balance, must be preserved, not only in dangerous places, but even on the level ground, and with all the assistance nature gives us by the law of gravitation. So it is with the soul. It is the link between the outer body and the starry spirit beyond. The divine spark dwells in the still place, where no convulsion of nature can shake the air. This is so always. But the soul may lose its hold on that, its knowledge of it, even though these two are part of one whole. And it is by emotion, by sensation, that this hold is loosed. To suffer either pleasure or pain causes a vivid vibration which is, to the consciousness of man, life. Now this sensibility does not lessen when the disciple enters upon his training. It increases. It is the first test of his strength. He must suffer, must enjoy or endure more keenly than other men, while yet he has taken on him a duty which does not exist for other men, that of not allowing his suffering to shake him from his fixed purpose. He has, in fact, at the first step, to take himself steadily in hand and put the bit into his own mouth. No one else can do it for him. The first four aphorisms of Light on the Path refer entirely to astral development. This development must be accomplished to a certain extent. That is to say, it must be fully entered upon before the remainder of the book is really intelligible except to the intellect. In fact, before it can be read as a practical, not a metaphysical treatise. In one of the great mystic brotherhoods, there are four ceremonies that take place early in the year which practically illustrate and elucidate these aphorisms. They are ceremonies in which only novices take part, for they are simply services of the threshold. But it will show how serious a thing it is to become a disciple, when it is understood that these are all ceremonies of sacrifice. The first one is this of which I have been speaking, the keenest enjoyment, the bitterest pain, the anguish of loss and despair are brought to bear on the trembling soul, which has not yet found light in the darkness, which is helpless as a blind man is, and until these shocks can be endured, without loss of equilibrium, the astral senses must remain sealed. This is the merciful law. The medium or spiritualist, who rushes into the psychic world without preparation, is a lawbreaker, a breaker of the laws of supernature. Those who break nature's laws lose their physical health. Those who break the laws of inner life lose their psychic health. Mediums become mad, suicides, miserable creatures devoid of moral sense, and often end as unbelievers, doubters even of that which their own eyes have seen. The disciple is compelled to become his own master before he adventures on this perilous path, and attempts to face those beings who live and work in the astral world, and whom we call masters, because of their great knowledge and their ability to control not only themselves, but the forces around them. The condition of the soul when it lives for the life of sensation, as distinguished from that of knowledge, is vibratory or oscillating, as distinguished from fixed. That is the nearest literal representation of the fact, but it is only literal to the intellect, not the intuition. For this part of man's consciousness, a different vocabulary is needed. The idea of fixed might perhaps be transposed into that of at home. In sensation, no permanent home can be found, because change is the law of this vibratory existence. That fact is the first one which must be learned by the disciple. It is useless to pause and weep for a scene in a kaleidoscope which has passed. It is a very well-known fact, one with which Bulwer Lytton dealt with great power, that an intolerable sadness is the very first experience of the neophyte in occultism. A sense of blankness falls upon him which makes the world a waste, and life a vain exertion. This follows his first serious contemplation of the abstract. In gazing, or even in attempting to gaze on the ineffable mystery of his own higher nature, he himself causes the initial trial to fall on him. The oscillation between pleasure and pain ceases, for perhaps an instant of time, but that is enough to have cut him loose from his fast moorings in the world of sensation. He has experienced, however briefly, the greater life. And he goes on with his ordinary existence, weighted by the sense of unreality, of blank, of horrid negation. This was the nightmare which visited Bulwer Lytton's neophyte and Zanoni, and even Zanoni himself, who had learned great truths and had been entrusted with great powers, had not actually passed the threshold where fear and hope, despair and joy, seem at one moment absolute realities, and the next mere forms of fancy. This initial trial is often brought on us by life itself, for life is, after all, the great teacher. We return to study it after we have acquired power over it, just as the master in chemistry learns more in the laboratory than his pupil does. There are persons so near the door of knowledge that life itself prepares them for it, and no individual hand has to invoke the hideous guardian of the entrance. These must naturally be keen and powerful organizations, capable of the most vivid pleasure. Then pain comes and fills its great duty. The most intense forms of suffering fall on such a nature, till at last it arouses from its stupor of consciousness, and by the force of its internal vitality steps over the threshold into a place of peace. Then the vibration of life loses its power of tyranny. The sensitive nature must suffer still, but the soul has freed itself and stands aloof, guiding the life towards its greatness. Those who are subjects of time and go slowly through all its spaces live on through a long-drawn series of sensations and suffer a constant mingling of pleasure and of pain. They do not dare to take the snake of the self in a steady grasp and conquer it, so becoming divine, but prefer to go on fretting through diverse experience, suffering blows from the opposing forces. When one of these subjects of time decides to enter on the path of occultism, it is this which is his first task. If life has not taught it to him, if he is not strong enough to teach himself, and if he has the power enough to demand the help of a master, then this fearful trial, depicted in Zanoni, is put upon him. The oscillation in which he lives is for an instant stilled, and he has to survive the shock of facing what seems to him at first sight as the abyss of nothingness. Not till he has learned to dwell in this abyss, and has found its peace, is it possible for his eyes to have become incapable of tears.